Well, let's pick it up where we left off last night. Let's do a quick review of what we talked about, because that sets the context for what we're going to be talking about here this morning. We started out talking about asking the question, how does the gospel grow? Our basic question is there life after campus? And a part of the answer is to understand how the gospel grew in the first century, because that is given to us not as being normative. We don't have to do it like they did in the first century, but it's a guide. It's an instruction. We can't return to the first century culture and relive that, but the Spirit of God saw fit to give us 13 letters by Paul and fill half of the book of Acts with the story of his life, and he intends that we take lessons from it, and so that's what we're doing. And what we saw was that squares can only reach squares, can only reach squares, can only reach squares. And if you're going to get beyond that, then you're going to have an apostolic effort. An apostle is sort of a spiritual entrepreneur. He's able to see what's there, seize opportunities, and make something of it. So he's able to go to rounds and leave them around. And in leaving them around, they have access to other rounds, and so the gospel is able to grow. The apostle doesn't stick around very long. He moves on. And we made a comparison between what happens on a campus and what happens when you move on into the other phases of your life. And so you are insiders in the sense that you have access to people around you that otherwise would not have opportunity with the gospel. You have a unique traffic pattern that is yours, and that is your calling. We'll be talking more about that later. So there's a great confusion, and I plead guilty to this in the past, where I would use the apostolic approaches to get things to happen and see them flourish on campus. And that's what we want to do. We need to keep doing that. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but we need to understand that when the person moves on from the campus, he has a whole other dynamic to deal with. And he's already connected into society. He has relationships. He has rapport with people that an apostle can only dream of. And it is an interdependence between the apostle and the insider. Because if the insider doesn't go on and bear fruit, then the apostle really, you know, he was running in vain. That's what Paul says about himself. If you do not go on, if you don't hold out the word of life, then I have run in vain. So once we see that these people are being fruitful, then we can go on to triangles. And we can reach triangles and stars and hexagons and all kinds of shapes in the world. But it takes new plantings as it goes on and grows. So the question is, what does it mean to be an insider? This is something that we haven't explored a whole lot in the past as a church, but it's something that we really need to face today. And so our theme for this morning, this first session, comes out of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. A time for everything. And in Ecclesiastes, if I can find it, says, there's a time for everything, a season for every activity under heaven. Often we have the idea that we have to do everything we're supposed to do in life right now. The problem with that is that we'll kill ourselves off as we try to do that, but there's a season for everything. So I want to pick up the story. We had this first generation of students move on in search of employment, and one moved to Timbaugh, another one moved to Lajes, another one moved to Petropolis, and so on. And they scattered out into the cities where they could find employment. They're in Brazil. This was in about 1969, 70, somewhere in there, 68. And so, as I told you last night, I watched them leave, and I asked the question, is there life after campus? And I thought, well, I need to go and make sure, because I'm not about to raise up another generation that would also fall into a black hole. So I got into my car, along with a friend, a Brazilian buddy, Aldo Berndt. And Aldo and I traveled over the next 18 months. We put 140,000 kilometers on our car. and got around to these towns. And what we saw, for instance, there was a young guy that just graduated from dental school. And he moved to a town, and they needed a dentist. He'd been there just a few months. When we visited him, we saw that his schedule was full. He had clients, as many as he could handle. But he was 5 years' income in debt already. Now, there's a problem. Another guy who was in a family that had a lot of industries in his area of the country, and the family was known for their dishonesty, their manipulations, and just don't do business with this family. And he just graduated from law school. And he was to be the lawyer for all of these industries. And so he asked, how can I be honest? And he was struggling with, how can I work with this, my family, and follow Christ at the same time? And he was struggling with that. Another couple we visited, a young doctor. And we sat down in their living room and began to talk. And it was like watching two ice cubes. I mean, they were just, there was nothing between the two. And we realized that here this new marriage was in real trouble. And then there was a guy that I just really dearly loved. And he moved to a city. He was an engineer and worked for the Brazilian oil company, Petrobras. And so he was just kind of out of the traffic pattern. It was just too many kilometers to even try to see him. So we tried to meet in São Paulo every couple of months, and we tried to just kind of, you know, keep him alive that way. But he was so far removed from everybody. And by the way, these people that graduated, they had no place to go. And that was in the sense of church. We couldn't say, go find a church and settle in. And in a sense, that was bad news. In a sense, it was good news. Because so often, that's just what we do. We say, oh, just go find a church. And the problem is that church is not set up to do the kind of thing that we're talking about. Like one pastor of a wonderful church told me, he says, you know, we have so much going on in here that we can't get out our front door. So to think about going to the lost is just beyond us. And that's a very, very common, it's kind of, things kind of close in on themselves. So many programs, so many activities, that a person becomes consumed by that, and the lost stay lost. And so we didn't have that. And the reason we didn't was that these were young intellectuals, university graduates. At that time, only one in every 10,000 youth graduated from a university. And so they were a cultural cut away from what was going on in evangelical church at that time. Now, things have changed in the last 20 years, and it's not quite as much, but it's still there. It's squares and rounds trying to relate to each other. And it's better to keep the rounds round. And so they had no place to go. So what do you do when you've got that going on? And then they start having children. Now, Brazil is a Freudian society. And if you know anything about Freud, you know that, I mean, it really gives you trouble when you get to child rearing. Because you don't want to discipline the child, because that's going to damage his ego. And so I've sat at a table where a three-year-old got up and walked across the tabletop and then got off. And the parents looked at me and shrugged their shoulders. What do you do? Because we can't, you know. And so parents are paranoid over their own kids because they don't dare discipline them. And so what happened was I realized that the things that I had studied and prepared myself for and what these people were going through were just, there was no connect. And so I realized that, and that's where I began to see how life has its seasons. And there are three seasons that I've defined here. You have the campus, runs from 18 to 25 years of age. If you get out of college by the time you're 25 now, that's kind of blinding speed, I guess. But Then there's the definition period of your life, when you go from 25 to about 40. And what I mean by definition is that it's in that period that your legacy is being defined. And what you're going to leave behind, what you're going to do, what you're going to accomplish is being defined at that point. And then there's the maturity, 40 plus. And that's when you begin to make your contribution. And so on campus, what we think about is just laying foundations, just get certain things there. And then when it comes to the definition period from 25 to 40, of course, this is rough. It depends on the life, I guess. But what we're after is transformation. And then when we get to the maturity, then we think about contribution. And so that's where the fruitfulness, that's where the generations are really going to be coming in on your life. And so on the campus years, what can you realistically expect to accomplish in a campus ministry? What can you realistically expect to have happen to you as a university student? Well, if four things happen, you're on your way. First one is to be rooted in Christ. Now, that's more than just believing in Jesus. Rooted in Christ is to be gripped by the truth of the gospel. To really understand grace, like in Colossians 1:6, he says, which has come unto you as it is in all the world and brings forth fruit from the day you understood the grace of God in truth. Not very many Christians really understand the grace of God. And so to have a person to be rooted in Christ is one of the things that we can aspire to on a university campus. Another thing is to have them... have people understand the importance of the Scriptures and have enough familiarity with the Scriptures so that they know that this is the go-to book. And they have enough familiarity that they can begin to find their way around. And then there's another one is you don't live the Christian life alone. You need one another. And so as you graduate and as you go on out, you're going to need a couple of soulmates to help you get along. And what we really did in Brazil was, you know, these couples would graduate, and they took a lesson from some of the people that kind of died out there on the fringes, and they would find jobs where they could stay together. And we would visit them, and we'd say, okay, who do you know around you that would be interested in what you're up to? Well, they'd name a few. And the next thing we'd know, next time we'd visit, there'd be half a dozen couples. And they'd be reading the Bible together. And they were a community. And we'll talk more about that later. And then the other is a vision for life. To understand that God is placing them where they are. And that they can accomplish all that God has in his heart for them in that place. And then there's the eternal challenge of what we talked about just in the introduction, the imitation of Christ, which there's no limit to that. Then we go on to the transformation period. And here we're faced with a whole new reality. Work, spouse, finances, children have to be a member of society and church. And what characterizes this period is that time is scarce. Time almost doesn't exist. And then the tendency when people get to that, instead of going to the Scriptures to find out how to do their work or how to relate to their spouse or how to handle their finances or how to raise their children, you know what people do? They revert to the way they were done with, into what happened to them, excuse the bad English, but you do with as you've been done. And so you're going to do with your own life as you've been done. And instead of going to the Scriptures, that's where they go. Now, how do you... And if you don't align your life with the scriptures, well, then your contribution years are going to be irrelevant. They're just not going to happen. There's a verse, there's a passage in Psalm 112 that we got up on the screen here. And this is a person, let's say, a person in the transformation period. This is what he's, this is his call for the future. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who finds great delight in his commands. His commands, that's this. And he references his life to his God's commands. His children will be mighty. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches are in his house. Why? Well, because he comes, it becomes a person of integrity and competence. And because he's responsible. His righteousness endures forever. He has a heritage, a legacy to pass on. Even in darkness, light dawns for the upright. So even in bad times, he's not wiped out. For the gracious and compassionate and righteous man, good will come to him who is generous and lends freely, who conducts his affairs with justice. Surely he will never be shaken. So, in these transformation period, or this definition period, if we do not reference our lives with the scriptures, then we have nothing to offer in the contribution years. The contribution years, as a person really makes a transition, his life takes on integrity, competence, character, and influence grows, and he's fruitful. But it takes time to get there. Now, the thing that is so disturbing to me right now in these days is that this alignment that we're talking about is very difficult. In fact, this could be the greatest challenge that you will face, because probably most of you will not make it. And the reason you will not make it is because it is not a part of our culture to make it. The pull in the other direction is in the water we drink. It's in the water we swim in. It's in the air we breathe. And this problem is what Francis Schaeffer called the upper and lower story. And so there's a split between the spiritual and the material in our culture. There's a dichotomy of truth. Francis Schaeffer called our attention to this. Not that it originated with him. In fact, it goes back. It's as old as human history, it seems. Because the Greeks, they had their idea that the upper story, the spiritual, is the real world. And up in the real world, the spiritual world, you had the archetypes, and so the material was just sort of a shadow of this real spiritual world. Well, then the church picked this up, and you find, in fact, in a number of the New Testament books dealing with kind of pre-Gnosticism, and it's the denial of the material world and saying what really was important is the spiritual world. And so a Gnostic will say, well, I can rob, steal, and fornicate as long as I keep a pure mind. And so the material, what I do materially isn't important. What goes on up here is the important thing. And the church fathers picked up on this, like Augustine or Augustine, however you pronounce it. Depends on which language you're speaking. But, I mean, his story illustrates this. He was a professor of rhetoric. And he in Alexandria, and there was this apologist, Jerome, who was preaching the gospel. And he had a Christian mother and a pagan father. And Augustine heard him and decided that, well, you know, if I become a Christian, I'm going to have to leave my post as a professor at the university. I'm going to have to leave my mistress and my child, give away my possessions, and go and live as a recluse in a withdraw from society. And Augustine made the decision, and then that's what he did. And what was he saying? See, he didn't get that out of the Bible. He got that from Greek thought. And that has been perpetuated all the way down the line. And so even today, I'm sure a lot of us in our minds, if you just reflect a little bit, you think, well, the spirituals is important. And my work, that's kind of second rate. And, you know, too bad I have to work for a living. That's kind of tacky. But what is really important is my times of devotion. See, we've bought into this dichotomy of truth. And then with the scientific revolution, Copernicus, hey, the world is not flat. He gave us a sun-centered universe, but he transformed our notions of cosmology. And then Newton, who just defined the law of gravity in modern physics. And then, of course, Charles Darwin, who in the area of biology made his contribution. It resulted in our inverting the priority. And so instead of the upper story being the important one, it's the lower story that's important. And so the conclusion was that science will get us there. Reason coupled with science, that is going to lead us to truth. Well, the postmodern has said there is no meta-story, and so both our hope in science and our hope in reason as being a guide to an ultimate story has disappeared. However, today the spiritual and material dichotomy rules in our life, and we've added adjectives to it. And so the material world is scientific. And the spiritual world, well, that's subjective. The material world, that's what's real. You can feel it. And the spiritual world is relative. And so, or another is that the material world, that's where reason, it's rational. And the spiritual world is unreal. The material world, that's where physics gives us answers that really apply, and whereas the spiritual world is just that's a matter of faith. And so the conclusion is the spiritual world, the upper story, is private. Keep it to yourself. The material world is real and is binding to all. You ever heard that? Of course you have. And that's where we live. And that's what makes it so difficult to bring congruence to these areas of our lives where, you know, the work, the relationships, and everything else. Because what happens is we leave certain things in the upper story, like having a quiet time, going to church, reading your Bible, and those kinds of things. But then we set that aside and we go do our work. And so we spend a few minutes in the upper story here and there and now and then, but then we live our whole lives in the material world. And really what this is, it's a philosophy of naturalism. And by that, it means that everything must be explainable in naturalistic terms. No God talk is allowed in any discussion. And you know this. If you want to pass an exam or whatever it is in your discipline, there are certain things that you have to put down on that paper if you want to pass. And that has really become a theology. And do you realize that this is as subjective as anything else? These are assumptions that people have latched onto, and there is no proof for this. And they say, well, we're being subjective. Well, so is the naturalist, or the philosophy of naturalism. So is the philosophy of naturalism subjective. And the basic belief is that there is no intelligence involved in the origins of the material universe. Just a couple weeks ago, dated December 21. Illustration of this. Judge rejects teaching intelligent design. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, December 20. A federal judge ruled on Tuesday that it was unconstitutional for a Pennsylvania school district to prevent intelligent design or to present intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in high school biology courses, because it is a religious viewpoint that advances a particular version of Christianity. And then it says this, John E. Jones III, the judge, issued a broad, stinging rebuke to its advocates. And so not only did they rule against anything else being possible, but there's a reaction against it. And so this is why what I say that what we face is very difficult. And successfully negotiating into your contribution years, you can't do that if you let that line remain between the spiritual and the material. So what happens is, I'm a great Christian. I'm an elder. And then I'm a Sunday school teacher. And then I get caught in the Enron scandal. Or like I have a friend. Got married not long ago to a lady that is in Bible study, that has her devotions every day, and then one day she got up and just left. And she, I'm out of this marriage. And so you have this strange behavior, this dichotomy between what a person professes to believe and what that person does in everyday life. All it is, friends, is the upper and lower story at work. That's all it is. We're just living in a way that's consistent with the way we think. We have allowed people to do this to us, to embrace this dichotomy. And so we say work is work, and the spiritual life is spiritual life, and let's not worry about bringing them together. There are lies in our society that we just accept without even thinking that leads us to reinforce this idea in our own minds. You owe it to yourself to achieve your full potential. How many of you believe that? Well, if you do, you've got the dichotomy. I need to look out for myself for a while. If it's not good for me, I'm out of here. I'll be happy when I get my new house, car, dress, girlfriend. These are all lies of our culture. We could go on and on and on. And it's like I said, it's in the air we breathe. So what do we do? You say, this is so complicated. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not an apologist, and I sure don't want to join the Republican Party. So, what do we do? Well, you know what? The answer is so simple, it'll blow your mind. The answer is found in responding to the same question that I described to you last night. The question is, who was that man? In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He was God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. What does that mean? Logos. Logos. Intelligence, wisdom, rationality, information. In the beginning was intelligence, wisdom, rationality, information. And intelligence, wisdom, rationality, information was with God, was God, and through Him all things were made. The basic claim about Jesus is that he is the originator of all things. And then John, in his letter, added an interesting little little insight into this. Look what he says. This is this which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched. Why did he add those? Which we have seen with our eyes, which our hands have touched. He's saying the spiritual has invaded the material. And it's not just some hallucination. It's not just some vision that we have. But we could look at him. We could smell him. We could follow him around. And so here is Jesus. And he is all that is God, reduced into human flesh, into a human being. Now, can you imagine that? Now, think about that for a minute. Here's this person. And you find him in a backwater Middle Eastern town doing carpentry work. And you say, yeah, sure. How does that work out? And, you know, it's just unbelievable. But then he opened his mouth. And this is in John 6, or rather Mark 6. Jesus left there and went to his hometown. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. Many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? What's this wisdom that has been given him, that he even does miracles? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And in the Luke account, in Luke chapter 4, it says that they ran him out of town. The people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff. So here is the Word becoming flesh. And you think, just one more ordinary guy. But then when he opened his mouth, we saw that he turned everything upside down in the way he addressed things. What story did Jesus live in? Upper story or lower story? Which story did he live in? Well, he destroyed the line between the upper story and the lower story. That's what he did. And so what we have in 2 Corinthians 10:5, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. So if you want to erase the line between the spiritual and the material, you focus on Christ. And as you do, what you'll find is that the things come together that didn't come together before. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, 16, 17, he says, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So what do I do with that? Well, I take my cues for life from him. We can't set out to resolve the split until we address the split in our own lives, our personal lives. And so as you move into the definition years of your life, Ephesians will give you an awful lot of guidance. Well, the whole New Testament will give you an awful lot of guidance. But, for instance, in Ephesians 4, 32, be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. So how do you relate? Well, you take your cues from Christ. He is the reference point. 5:1, be imitators of God as dearly loved children, and live a life of love just as Christ loved us. And so, again, the measuring point is Christ. Verse 21 says, submit to one another. How? Out of reverence for Christ. So we look at Christ, and we refer back to our own experience, and we say, how did he do it? Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. He's the reference point for your marriage. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. Bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Slaves, obey your earthly masters, just as you would obey Christ. Serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord. And so, this split and all of this chaos that we face in front of us, I tell you, you can pick your way through it. It will take every day or the rest of your life to do that. But he is your reference point. And as you do, what will happen is that this dichotomy that is enslaving our society, where there are contradictions in the way we believe and in the way we behave, those things will be erased as we fix our eyes on Christ. So this is huge. And we're going to go on in this this next session. We're going to pick up on this and talk about it further. But a couple of verses, Colossians 2:3 says, and it summarizes what I've been talking about here, says, in whom, talking about Christ, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Do you believe that? All the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in him. So, on the campus, it takes an apostle to help you just get cranked up and going. But when it comes to the definition years, you know what you're going to need in terms of leadership? To be able to do this, you're going to need one another. You need a few soulmates. Hebrews 3:13, encourage one another as it is called today. Lest any of you be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. And so, the point is, you don't need some grand leader to help you walk through this. But you're not going to do it all by yourself either. You need a little help from your friends. And the fact is, as the scriptures say, is that we can help each other walk along. And so the thing that I would leave with you as you are graduating and going on into your careers, make sure that you find some kindred spirits. Don't just join an organization or an institution, but become a part of a little network of people who have the same things on their heart that you have on yours.